This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's public conversation on the role of the motor vehicle in the Western Desert art movement, being held in conjunction with the Papunya Painting Out of the Desert exhibition, which is currently showing in the temporary gallery downstairs. Why motor cars? Well, in putting this exhibition together, what we've tried to do as much as possible is to ground the paintings in a broader cultural context, to try to get people to look through the paintings to the culture behind them. The role that vehicles have played in the painting movement has been and is a very central one, as you will hear today from today's speakers, all of whom have worked at one time or another with the artists featured in the exhibition. First of all, Jeremy Long has had a very distinguished career in Aboriginal administration, as well as in writing and research. He was a field and research officer with the Northern Territory Administration in the 1950s and 60s, and for many of the artists in the exhibition, he was the first white man that they ever met. Vivian Johnson has been researching the history of the Western Desert art for almost 30 years, and as well as her many academic achievements, she is, of course, a curator of the Papunya Painting Exhibition. John Keane currently works for Museum Victoria as a producer. He was an art advisor for Papunya Chula from 1977 to 79, and then later worked as a health administrator at Kintore when that community was established in the early 80s, where he worked until 85. And I entered the scene just after that and was a resident of Kintore for 4 years, where I worked for the Northern Territory Education Department. Now, we're going to start off today with a film that was shot by Ian Dunlop. The time is 1974. The place is Yai Yai, which is a small Pinabi community about 30 kilometres from Papunya. That was a kind of a breakaway community that was just established for Pinabi people. Now, this is before the Aboriginal Land Rights Act was passed, so it was actually a stage for the Pinabi in their movement, subsequent movement after the Land Rights Act was passed, to establish communities in their own homelands at places like Kintore and Kirikura. So we'll roll the film. So what we see here is local politics at work. Papunya is getting all the vehicles, Yai Yai gets none. I think in particular what this shows is how from very early on in the painting movement that paintings are being used to fund vehicles, a pattern that is repeated and continues to the present day. Okay, so now the order of the speakers will be Vivian will introduce Jeremy, followed by Vivian again, and then we'll have John Keane speaking after that. Now, if you could hold your questions to the end, till after the three speakers have each spoken, then we'll open it up for discussion. So, Vivian? Okay.
Good afternoon and thank you for coming. I'd like to pay my respects to the traditional owners of this land. The order of speakers is actually even a little bit more complicated than that, but we'll see how the hour evolves. I once asked Clifford Possum to tell me an Aboriginal joke. The only one he seemed to know, or that he told me, or that he told me anyway, was the story of the wild Pinterby and the Volkswagen. It went something like this. A group of wild Pinterby bought themselves a Volkswagen from one of those used car dealers in Alice Springs who specialise in unloading defective motor car on unsuspecting Aboriginal purchasers. They all piled into their new car and headed off back down the road to Papunya. Can you hear me? Yeah. About halfway there, the car broke down. Everyone piled out and the driver opened the bonnet at the front of the car to see what the problem was. No engine. At this point in the story, Clifford would exaggeratedly feign the terror of the wild Pinterby gathered around the empty boot, then laugh like crazy. Devil car, they said. Mamu, mamu. In a lather of fear, they pushed the car off the road and out into the middle of a nearby clay pan where they set fire to it and burned it to the ground. He recounted this tale with great hilarity on a number of occasions, though whether it was the story itself or my discomfiture at not knowing whether or not to laugh with him that amused him, I was never sure. It was okay for Clifford to laugh. He was not only laughing at the unsophisticated Pinterby who didn't know enough about cars to know that Volkswagens have the engine in the back, he was also laughing at himself, perhaps at the memory of his own moments of terror and vertigo when first faced with the white man's world, the experience his countrymen and women have called the running trees. This is an appropriate point to hand over to Jeremy, whose contribution to this afternoon's exploration of the relationship between cars and art in the desert is not so much about the cars or trucks as the roads on which they travelled and the men who made them and first used them. Neither Indigenous car culture, nor the art movement, nor much else in the recent history of Central Australia would have been possible without them.
Thank you, Vivian, and good afternoon all. Yes, I am talking about roads primarily, or principally one road, but cars, motor cars, do like roads, and we are talking, the outlined area are the Aboriginal reserves as in about 1960, surrounding the border area, and in the next image, you'll see the road about which I'll be primarily speaking, which is the road which leads to the land where the wild Pinterby dwell, or dwelt and now dwell again. From east of the, to your right, is largely the settled area of Central Australia, and the rest of the map is areas unsettled by white people. And rarely visited by white people until this road system was put in. It was put in for the purposes of the Weapons Research Establishment. Oh, I'll pause here for a moment.
Yeah.
The area to the right of the map, being the settled area, is an area inhabited by many Aboriginal people who were living on government settlements and in town, with very little money and virtually nobody except Albert Namatjira was the owner of a motor vehicle. Even motor vehicles are fairly rare amongst in the white population, except the public servants who had government cars to drive around in. There were people, Aboriginal people, working on the settlements. Several had driving licenses and were driving trucks, government trucks, four-wheel drives. Yes, to return to the trucks and the people who made the road, this is a picture of a burnt-out food truck that had been supplying Len Bedell and his road-building team from the Weapons Research Establishment based at Woomera, who had it in this year, 1960, had built a road up north from the Giles weather station in the south, past the Kintore Range, and then east to Mount Liebig and west, well into the desert to a place later known as Jupiter Well. On the way back, after their grader broke down, this truck caught fire, burnt all their food supplies, and was left there. It's since been moved to stand as a memorial in the nearby Aboriginal community of Kiwagura. But for some 40 years it was there to record the work of the road builders. It's marked the end of the first stage of the northern road system built by Len Bedell. They're surveying ahead his next line of road. And it was later in 1963 connected to the West Australian road system and greatly enlarging the scope too of the patrol officers who were based at Woomera, and who were their job was to ensure that the activities of the weapons research establishment didn't interfere with Aboriginal life. Of course, this road-making project, in fact, had a profound influence on Aboriginal life. Before the road was made, a notional system of roads and tracks, human tracks and camel tracks, had existed between the uninhabited country and the inhabited areas. The people from the west had been moving gradually in towards the settled areas out of curiosity and interest sometimes in where their relatives had already gone. And at occasional visitors, white people visiting with camel trains or trucks had penetrated at least to the margins of the area. They were looking for better country, or many of them for gold. Lassiter included, the Lassiter's search party included. Several teams of trucks came out in 1930. It was still possible to see some of these tracks occasionally. In 1957, when I first went out with a welfare branch patrol from the Northern Territory Administration, guided by two men who'd been in at least 20 years from their country, moving out by way from Haarsbluff through Ilbilly to Kintore and beyond. This took about 4 days for a journey that today takes a few hours. In a part, this was a response to a visit of about 30 people from the west who arrived at Haarsbluff from the Kintore Range. They are pictured. Who had come in response to a visit by a party including Charlie Tararo, who you heard speaking on the earlier excerpt from the film, who'd come out, gone out with camels to hunt for dingo puppies because you could get a pound for every dingo scalp you traded into the police. They met their relations out across the West Australian border, spoke highly of the attractions of the Haarsbluff settlement, where rations were available to people who would work and everyone could get a job. The response was quite keen, and a fairly large party set off. And at this point, which is near Ilbilly in the Ehrenberg Ranges, some of them decided it was all too far and too difficult in hot November and decided to turn back, lodged some of their unwanted belongings there, while the rest of the party, some 30 plus, moved on to Haarsbluff. This was a photograph I took as I went out a year later. 3 years after my visit, where we encountered one small family just over the West Australian border, another party from the welfare branch went out to see if there was anyone living in the area, and finding nobody, but they were surprised to find a road which had been built that year, as you saw it, in 1960. Nobody in the Northern Territory knew that this road was being constructed at that point, but they used it to drive south to Giles, and on the way met perhaps one of the first parties that were making use of the road, a mineral exploration party from the Department of the Bureau of Mineral Resources. The Dells party had not actually met any Aboriginal people, and not surprisingly, because they would have been making a great deal of noise, and presented a fairly frightening spectacle with their bulldozers and graders. But immediately, the year after the road had been completed, the purpose for which it was being built was pursued by a party of surveyors who were improving the map of Australia so that the Weapons Research Establishment would know where they were firing their rockets towards the northwest from Woomera. And they erected trig points on all the small hills and features like Windbaku or Mount Webb, which Bedell had been at pains to drive his road past. The following year, I persuaded people that I should go out again and see if there were any signs of people along the road and if there'd been any consequences from the surveyors having been out there. It was clear that there had been contact with some of the people there, with the survey parties. We weren't far over the border before these small boys stopped the Land Rover in our party and running onto the road, and their father and uncle joined them and guided us into their camp nearby. As we continued to visit these people over the next 3 years, and one feature of our journeys was to always make a point of visiting an area well to the west where I found a curious species of acacia, which is almost a ready-made spear. You here see one potential spear being uprooted, and our vehicles were always laden with heaps of spears which could be taken back to Papunya and were a useful trade item. I won't go into the details of all the following visits, but the consequence of all these friendly encounters between the people still living in the desert and their relatives from the east who had moved earlier was that the drift in, which halted rather because of the great distance that had to be covered, was resumed, and the men immediately after our 1962 visit, three or four of the men walked in, were duly taken back to rejoin their families, but then again walked in with their families. And after 2 years of this sort of process, it was decided that there really weren't enough people living out there to provide a viable community for themselves, and that they all wanted to be given a lift in. And this duly happened, both here and further in this eastward movement and further west. So we went out in 64 with a truck equipped to carry people, and brought more people into Papunya. In the following years, there was not a great deal of contact with the western areas, but people longed to restore their connection with the area. And from time to time, the Institute of Aboriginal Studies, which was then called, neighbour to this museum, provided money for researchers studying various things from music, the use of stone tools, and ultimately funded trips by their film unit to film ceremonies at sacred sites in the Pintubi country. The first of these in 1969, another one in 1970, and then the third in 72. The first to Yumari, which features in many of the important paintings. The next at Yarru Yarru, a little further west, and at Bita Kadjuri, southeast of Kintore in 1972. This was done by hiring Pioneer Bus and loading 30 eager male people onto the bus and ferrying them out 300 miles to the site where their ceremonies were filmed. This was, I think, probably a great revelation to the people concerned of government, Canberra. White people of importance were interested in their culture and were spending apparently vast sums of money on hiring buses to travel enormous distances. And somehow I think it's no coincidence that the sites that were featured in these films figure largely in the paintings that began to be painted just at this period, shortly after this 69 and then the 1970 visits. I think that's probably enough for me, and I'll hand over to Vivian.
It's a perfect point of entry to this next part of my talk. I was intending to show you a few short excerpts from the film Mr. Patterns in order to illustrate a different but in some ways more light-hearted point about the origins of the painting movement than the one that Jeremy just made, namely that it had its origins in the relationship of a group of men and a car, based on Geoffrey Bardon's account in Mr. Patterns, sorry, that's apropos of nothing in particular, but it's just incredible. he arrives in this blue combi van with his worldly possessions on board, and talks about how he used to use it to take the children to the swimming pool, to take people out to get firewood, to take them in hunting, and down to the airstrip to teach them how to drive, which was a very important part. And these exchanges, which centred around this car of his and the access he gave the artists the men, they weren't artists, many of them then, to this car with the way the bond formed between them. And it was just as important to them in many ways as the art materials he soon after began to supply them with. And it was also this combi that he loaded up with all the paintings and took them into Alice Springs and made those first sales, which had such an impact on the artists. Okay. That's actually Tim Pionka sort of giving you a lesson. And there's a big painting on the boot of that car. We'll get to John soon, who talks about the equation between cars and paintings. But back to Clifford for the moment. Like the accomplished storyteller he was, Clifford told the tale of the wild Pintubi in the Volkswagen as if it had really happened. So the question for us today is, how would the wild Pintubi have got the money to buy themselves a car? And the only possible answer is from the sale of paintings. It's unlikely they excelled at card playing, which was another popular way for people to amass enough money through winning at cards to be able to afford a vehicle. And of course, everyone who lost money in the card game is entitled to ride in the card too, which may explain why Aboriginal cars plying the back roads of Central Australia have their tailgates scraping the dirt, so laden are they with passengers. Apart from winning at cards, there were other ways in the early 1970s to get your hands on enough money to buy a car, but they were mostly illegal. For instance, it was rumoured among the white settlement staff that Carpa Jampa Jimpa, the first chairman of the Punitula artists, used to fund car purchases with the money made from grog running. Certainly, Carpa became the prime mover when the painting movement came along, offering a less risky and potentially far more lucrative income stream. Remember that he took out the 1971 Caltex Prize right at the beginning of the movement, while the Papunya school mural was being painted. The prize money in itself was enough to buy a set of wheels. For the purposes of this analysis, we might take the liberty of extrapolating from Geoffrey Bardon's testimonial to Carpa and say the painting movement was built around this man's incredible ability to paint and his indomitable will to car ownership. Jeremy's already mentioned Namajira, and I just wanted to kind of balance out the emphasis that is often placed in discussions of the beginnings of Papunyatula on the Pindaby by talking about the connection between Carpa and Namajira and his school of watercolourists. It was Namajira who introduced the vocation of artists to Aboriginal Central Australia, and in particular to men like Carpa and his cousins, Tim Lura, Clifford Possum and Billy Stockman. Clifford Possum once told me that he and Carpa and Tim Lura had been painting before Geoffrey Bardon arrived in Papunya at the beginning of the 1971 school year. And one of the things that was very significant about Namajira, as Jeremy observed, is that he owned a car, which in itself was testimony to the value of this vocation of artist. And that was how he had obtained the car. The car, you'll notice, this is the famous Albert Namajira car that was given to him in the 1940s by Ampol, but it's evident from the slide that Jeremy showed that he was able to buy more cars too as time went on. So I think it's important to remember that. And the movement actually involved the coming together of people like Carpa and his cousins who'd come from this experience of observing the Hermannsburg School of watercolourists and their activities as an artist and the respect and income that it brought them and the motor cars. And, of course, the wild Pindaby, though we should stop calling them that. That was something that people, a way that people that were themselves Indigenous and who had once perhaps been wild and Najra or wild Walpri or something, felt able to refer to people like who had recently come in and with all the strength of a lived experience of country and the traditional way of life of the Western Desert peoples. Perhaps what united them, for argument's sake, was the dream of car ownership. Car fever was behind, moving right along now, car fever was behind the pressure on Peter Fannin, who followed in Geoffrey Bardon's footsteps as inaugural manager of Papunyatula artists, to increase the scale of the paintings. For one thing, you had to get all the money to buy the car in one hit. If you only got small amounts, they were quickly expended on consumables. So it was very important to have a large painting so that you could get a lot of money at once, and then you would be able to expend it immediately on a car. And John is going to tell you about that in a moment. The painters, this is back in the early 1973, were demanding ever larger boards on which to paint. So large that in the end they were a nightmare for Fannin to package and ship interstate to what meagre markets there then were for the paintings. Fannin had the idea of introducing cotton duck as a solution to his difficulties. He once told me that he'd read an article about the tombs of the pharaohs in Egypt and the durability of cotton duck, which he deduced from that experience. But he later told me that some art world people had come up and suggested this solution to him. But however it came about, it produced an artistic revolution in Papunya, the results of which you will see downstairs in the temporary gallery. I'll move quickly over the role that the Aboriginal Arts Board played in making the finance available to create these very large canvases, which equated to a motor car. Without the Aboriginal Arts Board's support, they would never have been able to put so much of the company's meagre resources in what were at that time virtually unsaleable objects. But in retrospect, these very large canvases, these motor car ones, as they used to refer to them, were one of the great artistic and cultural achievements of the first decade of Papunya painting. They also had political ramifications, and I'll just stop at this point and let John go into describing this era that followed the passing of the 1976 land rights legislation, with a quotation from, again, from Charlie Tarrer, who seems to be quite vocal in this discussion, though perhaps John can comment on his fortune as a car owner, I'm not sure. But he did say of these very large paintings and of the importance of the painting movement in general, "If I don't paint this story, some white fellow might come and steal my country." This was a dimension of at least Charlie Tarawa's understanding of the social and political context in which the paintings of the late 70s were created.
I'd like to pay my respects to the Indigenous people of the Canberra area and also to the artists that I was fortunate to work with at Papunya. It was a formative experience of my working life, and as a result of that I'm invited to opportunities like the exhibition here. So it's been a fantastic experience for me, though sort of tinged with sadness and comic events, as life in the desert always is. As Vivian indicates, I've called this canvas Motokari because there is a direct equivalence between canvas and motor cars, and I'll tell you a few stories that sort of amplify and explore that relationship. This is a motor car one, 12 foot by 10 foot canvas by Shorty Lunkara. Another motor car one, 12 foot, again 12 foot by 10 foot painting by Turkey Tolson Jabarula. These were standard stretches, painted in turn. We only had a limited number of stretches that would be assembled on at the artist's camp. And this is a story about the cars that were purchased for these paintings, and I'll go into specific detail about which cars were purchased for which paintings later on. When the other cars in the story are the cars of the art advisors. When I arrived in Papunya in January 1977, the Papunya car was this incredibly muscular and tough-looking Ford F100. It's had rugged, good looks, kind of like a Mustang, but with much better load-carrying capacity. So it could carry either a whole lot of rolled-up canvas or up to about 12 people with the tailgate dragging on the dirt. When I'm showing you these pictures, these are pictures of the type of car that I've got from the net. The pictures of real things are full screen. So the little ones are there for your enjoyment and illustration only. When I arrived at Papunya, I didn't have a licence, and to take on the job as art advisor, I was 22 at the time, I had to get my licence. And soon after I took on the job. I made the same mistake that seemed part of the tradition of art advisor as a papunya, of rolling the vehicle. Unlike other art advisors like Peter Fannin and Dick Kimber, who, you know, had the same kind of upside-down experience in the desert, mine, there's no excuses for other than my youth, inexperience and stupidity. This is what it felt like as a young fellow driving that F100. After that, I drove it much more carefully. When that car got taken into Alice Springs to be panel beaten, Dick Kimber, who is a figure behind, you'll see his name referred to in films, and he's a figure that sort of spans the whole history of Papunya Chula, a white fella. He loaned me his Holden HK, so I was still able to get around and fulfil the business. And that was a really reliable car. Everyone had seen Dick go out to Papunya and drive around Alice Springs for years, you know, making his morning trip to the post office in this car. And Tim Lura Jabaljari so admired the reliability of this car when I returned it to Dick. He insisted that he was able to... He would purchase it for a very reasonable price. I couldn't resist putting this painting in because I think it's absolutely sublime, and it has characteristics of Tim's personality, his subtlety and his capacity to engage with all of the art advisors and other European people involved with the art movement at that time, and to charm them to an extent that they would sell their car to them at a very low price. The next person I'll talk about is Shorty Lunkara Jungarai. He was in lots of ways the most powerful person in Papunya at that time. He was the most feared by the eastern dwellers, the non-Pintabi. He was a Nunkari, a traditional healer, and his paintings convey this extraordinary power, expanding power. They start with little oval circles and expand out in amazing ways to fill the canvas and go beyond into, you know, what's an infinite space, really. This is a large painting that he produced as one of a series for the... We had a commission for 5 motorcar-sized canvases for the Paris Embassy. As soon as he produced the painting at Warrawea, which is even further west out towards the end of the McDonnell Ranges, and hopped in the F100 with some of his sons and other young men in the back of the F100, we went into Alice Springs and went to the car yards just to the north of town. By this stage, Lunkara was getting quite anxious because he was very unfamiliar with Alice Springs. And he just wanted to, you know, get a car, get out of town. He saw this one and said, you know, it's got a lot of room for the family. And it fitted his other criteria. It was under $1,000 that he got for the painting. And everybody, Don Jabaljari, got in the driver's seat. Lunkara was in the passenger seat, and they took off out of the car yard and went. If any of you have been to Alice Springs on those curvy roads on the going north out of town, it didn't even make it out of those hills before it broke down. So everyone waited there on the side of the road until they could get a lift back into Alice Springs. And then they got the used car dealer to take them back to try to fix up this car so it could move again. By the time they got back up there, someone had stripped all the wheels off the car and it was just sitting there. So Lunkara, for all his power, sort of gave up and just went back out to Warrawea with nothing but regret. This is the only image that I had available of Lunkhara. It's towards the end of his life, and it doesn't convey him in that full power state. This is, he had got Parkinson's disease in the 80s, and he was physically reduced, and he lost the nunkari, the magical qualities that he had earlier had. Uddhoda Jangala was another man of extraordinary power. He's the owner of the site Yumari, that is the feature of the big painting you meet first when you go into the exhibition. And Yumari is the site that Jeremy talked about, people going out to make the film. Uddhoda made a couple of big canvases, and somehow he kept hold of that money enough to go into town. He bought a car similar to this, and from the same sharks outside, just north of town. And again, he took off full of optimism back to the outstation. He got just a little bit further, but didn't get quite to the turn off to the dirt road that runs to Papunya and Yundamu, and went back into town to try to get assistance with this car. He stayed with his family, who was living close by, and although he was never a drinking man, on this particular night he got really drunk. And he ended up going into town and knocking on the door of an apartment. Inside the apartment there was a group of cadet police, young policemen, and they'd been drinking for hours in their apartment. So they opened the door and there was this drunken old Aboriginal fella there who they couldn't understand a word he was saying. And he was a very insistent man, Uddhoda. Anyway, so they started to manhandle him out, and he resisted. They started punching him, so he picked up his knife and slashed out at them, and cut into one or two of these young policemen, and ended up getting taken to the police station, and then carted off to the monkey house, where he was locked up for a few days until he went to court. A couple of years ago, I ran into the judge at that event, who recalled the events really clearly, and he ended up dismissing the case as a classic case of cultural misunderstanding. Another more optimistic story is one of Turki Tolson Jubarulla, who bought for this last large canvas a fantastic car. This model, in fact, this colour, a Fawn 8 Holden HR, and he used that car reliably over quite a few months to get back to Kungayunti, which was 100 k's west in Sandhill country. That's the perfect story of what second-hand cars should do in the desert. It really works out like that. Let's go back one. This is the company car in the background. If you look at the new car, this is a Toyota Land Cruiser. It was big, powerful, and very reliable. It could go anywhere. And as we all know, Toyotas have become the car of choice in the desert. You could get yourself out of any tricky situations, and it had a big load-carrying capacity. So it could do everything that was required of a car out there. It took Johnny Warangula and a party of people out to Chikari, his ancestral place. This is part of the party visiting a place near Junti on the way, and this is where we were going, paintings of Warangula's cave site at Chikari. There's the man himself. Anyway, Warangula went, he made the his outstation at Ilbili. That's on the edge of his traditional country that Jeremy referred to a little later. And when there was a boar sunk there, so he went back there after 40 years. About 40 years after leaving the country. No, maybe not so long. Anyway, eventually he got a car similar to this panel van, and in a way it sort of broke up that harmony that he'd got at Ilbili, because it meant he could run backwards and forwards into town. Warrangal did like a drink, and you know, sitting out there for a couple of weeks, he felt like going into town. So those are the stories. It's a story of equivalence, where paintings and the cars have this capacity to go back to country, to provide independence, but also they lent to entanglement. Later on, the stories became conflated with this car that was produced, was it starred in the Bush Mechanics TV show, where the painting has become the car and the car's the painting. So I'll leave that one there for you to contemplate.
We're going to have to leave out the story of Mrs. Bennett and her Toyota, which is another sad story. I just wanted to wrap up by kind of bookending this with at least my contribution with that extraordinary car from somewhere between 1899 and 1928 in Arnhem Land, which is even before the commercial bark painting movement developed. It's quite an enigma, which I found by accident and which I intend to explore further. And this it came up on Google when I typed in Aboriginal art car looking for this one, which is Michael Jagamara Nelson's original BMW art car. I guess I'd just take a little bit out of what John said to say that this access to motor vehicles, which the success of the art movement has made possible, are moving from the kind of vehicles that John was talking about to nowadays the word on everyone's lips is not Motokai 1, but Toyota. But it's the same kind of thing, except people now get further than the hills outside Alice Springs or the Tanami Road turnoff. They go all over the place. They go to all the interrelated communities that ties of kinship require and permit. People have done studies on the mobility of people in desert communities, and it's to a factor of two or three for people who are well-known artists. That there's people are in constant motion, perhaps even as much as they were in pre-contact times. This has its downsides in community breakdown and the problems, all the problems of which we're all too familiar, which are its symptoms. But on the brighter side, perhaps we might say that this is also a form of Aboriginal self-determination, a kind of reinvention of the old peripatetic lifestyle funded by the proceeds of painting sales. And I guess this art car of Michael Nelson's is a way of making this point. He aboriginalised this icon of European motorsport by inscribing it with his title deeds under the laws of Western Desert Art and Culture. Note the raised fist. Charlie Tarawa would surely have approved. Thank you.
That was a really wonderful series of presentations. Some fantastic stuff there. I'm sure you've all got lots of questions. If I could invite the speakers to come up to the stage. And we've got about 10 minutes for questions.
This is just to the panel. I mean, were there other examples of kind of items of consumption that also became not quite a kind of a source of equivalence about paintings, but were there other items or goods that were highly sought as well, or did the motor car stand so much in relief in terms of ambition about what the economic benefits that might accrue from the paintings meant and then would lead people to. Is there anything else really that...
Sure.
Yeah. The car stood out totally in relief, but it was only large paintings that could get anywhere near purchasing a car. So the other smaller paintings, 3 foot by 4 foot or small boards or those sorts of things, just went into, the weekly budget. Cars were way up there. Later on, other consumer items of equivalent importance in that sort of outstation movement and people getting back to Kintore were two-way radios, though they weren't purchased from the proceeds of cars. But the painting movement, the Pinderby painting movement and the outstation movement were really intertwined, and the paintings were one way in which the Pinderby got leverage within government to push that aspiration. Another thing they needed when they got there was a means of ready communication, and two-way radios were key to that. Hats, I don't know, maybe you can buy a hat for a cowboy hat for a small board.
I was just wondering, you mentioned, Vivian, about the notion of running trees. I was wondering if you could tell me if there's any more kind of direct link, I suppose, between the visual and sort of, experiential experience of automobility and its relationship to the production of art, so that, the kind of the actual visual, aside from just the size of the canvas and the purchase and the production, but the actual visual ramifications.
Mm. Well, I might give John a go at this too. I mean, the thing that we always say about the paintings is that they're topographical. That it's an aerial perspective, and I suppose going back to Matt's question before, I mean, that mobility. It's not about, even though the cars that John showed us were magnificent, if you're into that sort of thing. I mean, I think it's actually about mobility. Mm-hmm. That it wouldn't matter what kind of vehicle it was in the end, if it went, and in the same way, people do enjoy travelling further afield, and I know that I've spoken to people after their first trip, a bit long trip to Sydney or something, and they do talk about the way seeing the landscape like that from the air has enhanced their own painting experience. But for the moment, I'm just drawing a blank on the motor car and the paintings. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, John?
Not in the way that an experience of sitting in a motor car affects how you see the paintings. I think those striped paintings of sandhills are probably not things zooming past your eye at 100 kilometres an hour. But I think when people moved back to Kintore, it put them, when Pinderby people moved back to Kintore and away from the political influences of Aranda people and Lurcha people in Papunya, that put them back in the social orbit that Jeremy was more familiar with, where some of their relatives had gone to Balgo, some had gone to Warrakuna, some had gone to Well 33, out on the Canning Stock Route. And when they got back into that orbit, artistic expressions that were emerging simultaneously in Balgo started to affect this started to be a really very distinctive way of Pinderby application of paint that was different to what was happening in that very careful single dot thing that was happening at Papunya.
Down front.
Oh, Vivian, you started to mention at one point the political aspect of the paintings in terms of title deeds. Just wonder if you want to elaborate on that a bit.
Yeah, John didn't really pick that up in his talk. I mean, it was the fact that people, but though the references to outstations is actually a way of picking that up, though I didn't make that connection. in that that passage of Charlie Towers is actually quite a well-known one, and it, at least it occurs in anonymously in the Charlie Tower retrospective catalogue. One assumes it's him, though perhaps it was someone else, but it's put there as an encapsulation of a very politicised view of what the Land Rights Act might have meant. Whereas, John, I don't, you might want to elaborate on this, but the idea of what it actually meant to people there was something more about going back to country, about being feeling, and you mentioned it too, Peter, the idea that people responded to that by saying, well, now that our ownership of that country is acknowledged, which we've never doubted anyway, now we want to go and live there. I think they always wanted to go and live there, but they felt as though there was some kind of recognition of ownership and even support from the government for that. In terms of the paintings, the other dimension of it was the way all the anthropologists from the Central Land Council and so forth came out with maps and pieces of paper and were actually drawing up the sites for which people were responsible. So that, and that was actually a European title deed, so perhaps they drew that analogy. You might want to talk more about that, John, in terms of Clifford's title deeds, for example, or anyone else's.
Well, the paintings are, at their most essential level, I suppose, representation of country and the symbolic, and particularly what's great about Papunya painting in the 1970s and most of the first half of the 1980s is that the symbolic elements of that represent the country are very explicitly painted. You know, and that's why I think the show will be quite revolutionary. It'll put focus back on that period where you could see the dreaming, and the paintings look very much like the ceremonial stuff that was made that informed the paintings, you know. Whereas now they're all very much more abstracted and held back or more detailed. You know, there's that kind of explicit representation isn't there, where, you know, you've got the symbols, that's the country, you know, there's an equivalence between what the painting's representing and people's relationship to a bit of particular site or constellation of sites.
I think concurrent with that as well is there's been a geographical shift in the location of the Papunya Chula itself now, where the main regional centres are in Kintore and Kirikura as a result of the Pindabis movement back into those areas and establishing communities there. And vehicles have obviously played a major role in that movement. But I think you get a sense from looking at the exhibition and also from what people are saying today and listening to Jeremy, you know, there are these distinct periods in the, you know, development. I mean, mobility is obviously important in people's lives, but it played a different role at different times. And the 70s was clearly a very distinctive period in the history of Pindabi people's move back to their homelands with the passing of the Northern Territory Lands Rights Act in 1976 and the establishment of communities further west, which sort of ushered in a new period of painting. But in the period in which the paintings in the exhibition came together, people's mind was very much focused on, particularly those Pindabi people living at Yaayai, was on getting back to their own country. And vehicles were essential for them to achieve that goal. Is there any more questions?
Thanks very much. I just had a question. I've always had this romantic idea of artists painting because of some need to express something. And here you've got the sort of commodification of the art. And I wonder whether the artists themselves saw themselves as artists who could gain, you know, a car as a result of their art expression, or whether there was a more deliberateness in the purpose of creating the painting, even to the extent of giving it a name, you know, the motor car one. Where did you see the artists on this dynamic? Were they creating this in order to get a car, or were they creating art that... Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
It's an interesting dynamic. Yeah.
Well, maybe we
How long
have
we
it?
Got?
That's 2 minutes.
You have a go.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, obviously, the kind of paintings we're talking about, I mean, it's not just something that someone dashed out to get a car, you know. But I think we perhaps, as I said before, it's not just about having a flash car that's an extension of your ego or something in the way that we might think about car ownership. It's about what one can do with a car. The car is a practical thing that enables you to go to country, to support your family, to be somebody within your community who has resources that then give you a place in that community. And people are they're engaged with the idea of artists, but not in our kind of romantic way of thinking about artists. It's very much tied up with their position within the society and their cultural power and responsibilities and all of that. I flashed past an image of the painting of Umari in my talk, and there were a whole heap of people all sitting around doing that, and it was a sociable event, but it was also a deeply significant cultural event that was taking place. So I think we can't really transpose our ideas of what it means to be an artist onto these men.
Can I just say really quickly on that also there's a spectrum within the artists of Poniatchula. In the 70s, there was a real spectrum of relationship to painting, where you get Tim Lura, experimenting in that whole emotional range that is thought to be central to European painting. And then you've got very mechanistic reproduction of iconographic elements by other artists that have nothing of that sort of aesthetic personal response. So, you know, there's no... You can't point the needle in any particular place and say that's what it is, because there were 50 men at that time all responding in various ways.
I guess so. I would take... I don't think the spectrum goes quite to mechanistic, dotting. I mean, each and every person is painting their dreaming, mm-hmm. and they have a strong emotional relationship to it. So,
to the meaning of the work, but maybe not the...
In the execution of it, okay.
It's an expression that actually draws together the commodification aspect of mobility in Toyota and its purpose, which is for dreaming and the reinforcing of cultural connection to country. So that sort of expression is rather useful to draw together those two aspects that can't really be separated in this context.
Well, we might... just one up the back there.
Could you just say... say something about the role of women in the movement at that time?
No. They weren't involved in the movement at that time, except, I guess one thing you could say about this, if we're...